Esther 8, beginning in verses 3 to 5. And Esther spake yet again before the king, and fell down at his feet, and besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman the Agagite, and his device that he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king, and said, "If it please the king, and if I found favor in his sight, and the things seem right before the king, and I be pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews, which are in all the king's provinces." I've said on a number of occasions, the book of Esther has been telling us the story of that contest between the seed of the woman, the church, and the seed of the serpent, that is, the enemies of the people of God, personified in the devil. The themes of this book turn and hinge upon the obedience of faith versus the wicked pride of unbelievers. Throughout this book, the pulse is the special providence of God toward His church. And so at every point, with every movement, each movement of the characters, we see those subtle coincidences, or happenstances, as some would call them. Others would refer to this as fortune or luck or chance, but that's godless terminology. These are meaningful coincidences, otherwise known by the Jews as small miracles, which follow one upon another until only those who lack the capacity of faith could fail to see it's the hand of God. Now, for a book that never makes an actual mention of God or the divinity or any direct acknowledgement even of something beyond nature, this book presents one of the most compelling cases for a special providence of God toward the church, at least if we believe the history of events that were being told within its pages. So, as it tells this story, it is also, I believe, foreshadowing something of great importance for us to learn who live now during the Christian era. Remember what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11. Referring to these Old Testament stories, he says, "Now, all these things happened unto them for ensamples," or for types. "And they're written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come." These are types. Now, earlier I noted some things concerning the figures in the book of Esther and certain relations to the arrangements of church and state. And I want now to draw some of the lines a bit more clearly, and I want to place them in the context of this struggle between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. Especially as we approach that time which is called in the book of Revelation the millennium, like the 1,000 years, when there will be a proper relation between magistracy and ministry, when the lion shall lie down with the lamb. Isaiah chapter 11 tells us that that shall be a time when the knowledge of the Lord covers the earth as the waters cover the sea. But how shall this contest end in such an arrangement as that? How can we go from this ages-long conflict between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent to this millennial glory? Well, I would like to suggest to you that Esther has been hinting all along and will continue to hint at how this will actually come to be. I want you to recall that at the beginning of the book, Persia is simply one of the four beasts, one of the ungodly empires that have been dreamt about by Nebuchadnezzar and foretold in the book of Daniel. At the commencement of that reign of rise of the Persian Empire, the king Ahasuerus, who is the head of an anti-Christian kingdom at this time, is married to Vashti, a prideful and wicked heathenish queen. Now, this marriage, I would suggest to you, represents that cooperation of church, Vashti, and state, Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, under pure heathenism. Right? The fact is that it's a modern lie that you can have a secular state. There is no such thing as a secular state. Right? There's always a religion that goes along with that kind of situation. They may not call it a religion, but a religion it is indeed. It's a religion that teaches men how to pray. Like, they have anthems and they have pledges of allegiance to teach you how to obey your superior power. And they have their feasts, which are attended with games or playtime. Just like the children of Israel, when they made that golden calf, they worshiped before it and then they rose up to play. And so, on their holy days, they have times of devotion and times of play. Why do you think they spend so much time making sure football games fall on those days? We find that through the diaspora, Jews have entered this kingdom of the Persians. And they're represented by Mordecai, the prophet of God, a man not only in covenant with God, but himself a covenanter, actively pursuing the ends of the covenant through faithful obedience. Now, with the removal of Vashti and her presumed death, there's a termination of the covenant between the heathenish king and queen, or the heathenish state and church. And since, as I said, no state can exist happily without some religion, Ahasuerus is seeking a new wife, a new covenant with a new representative of a new church. And he sorts through a variety of options. And finally, he finds a candidate from amongst the various provinces of his kingdom named Esther. Now, Esther is the personification of the true religion come into covenant with the state. She's a picture, more particularly, I think, of the witnessing church at the beginning of the millennium, or just prior to the millennium. Significantly, Ahasuerus doesn't come to the true religion on his own, because the state has no religion per se, because it has nothing to teach. The true religion is professed by him, at least at the first, through his connection or covenant with Esther. After all, as covenanter martyr James Renick expressed it so well, he said, "The magistrate is not a magistrate as a Christian, but as a man." And so Ahasuerus governs as a man. But the fact is, this man must choose rightly. Shall he reign as a heathen? Or is he going to reign as a believing covenanter? He has to settle his loyalties, and he has to demonstrate whether or not his covenant profession that he's made in his marriage vows is genuine or spurious. Whether it's an expression of his own real personal devotion or merely an outward show that he puts on from time to time. Now, Esther has been crowned. She's been brought into covenant with the king. She is, as a Jewess, an Old Testament saint and covenanter, one already in covenant with God. Her orthodoxy and connection to the true religion is guaranteed by her close relation to her cousin Mordecai, who had raised her as a father when her own father had died. Now here too, I think we see that Esther, the church, in Esther, we see that the church, both the true church and the false church, is portrayed in Scripture as a woman. And so in Esther, the true church, we come to understand, has a genesis with two beginnings. Right? There's one natural, but that is ended in death, like the covenant of works made in Adam. But there's another one that's taken up by a near kinsman, Mordecai. He's a kind of kinsman redeemer, or a type of Jesus Christ, as were all the prophets to some degree. Mordecai is taken from the same family. Christ has taken upon himself not the nature of angels, but the seed of Abraham. He's taken from the same family, and he undertakes for orphaned Esther a covenant of life and makes her to be as his own child. I want to pause and note here something. According to Jewish theology, they haven't really brought this out clearly hitherto, the teaching of the rabbis is that Esther is actually the wife of Mordecai, who is in turn then allowed to marry the king. Now, without adopting some of what I would consider the sillier and more grotesque aspects of their thoughts on this, I do think it's worth noting something. And that is that this institution actually mirrors the Christian teaching that the church is the bride of Christ, if we understand Mordecai to be a type of Christ as a prophet. Moreover, the Old Testament prophesies that the state will establish the church in the various nations sometime at the latter end of the New Testament era. So in Isaiah 2:2, it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house, that's the church, shall be established in the tops of the mountains. Mountains are kingdoms, so it's the kingdom of the kingdoms of the Lord's house shall be established in the tops, or the heads of the mountains, the kingdoms, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. But additionally, we're told that kings, particularly Gentile kings, shall be nursing fathers or nourishers to the Israel of God. Isaiah 49:23. And kings shall be thy nursing fathers, and their queens, thy nursing mothers, they shall bow down to thee with their face toward the earth and lick up the dust of thy feet. And thou shalt know that I am the Lord, for they shall not be ashamed that wait for me. Likewise, there's a promise of destruction to the kingdom that will not serve the church and people of God. Isaiah 60:12, for the nation and kingdom will not serve thee, meaning Israel, O Israel, the nation and kingdom will not serve thee, O Israel, shall perish. Yea, those nations shall be utterly wasted. So, what I want to say is the notion that Esther is both, in some sense, both the bride of Mordecai, again, a type of Christ, as well as in covenant with or to the king, which is a picture of the church nationally established, is actually a theologically sound notion. And it makes me wonder sometimes how the Jews stumble into some of these thought patterns prior to Christ. And yet, we know that by the time of Christ, they are very keen to hide this and even deny it. Now, with the elevation then of Esther to be queen, what we see is the king entering into a covenant with the true church. when it's just Esther, I think we're talking about the witnessing church. You know, Esther versus the Jews who are scattered are the difference between Elijah and the 7,000 that have not bowed the knee to Baal. Right? We don't know who those Jews are that are scattered through the kingdom. We know they're there. But we do know who Esther is because she's the one who's speaking the word of God. And there are two witnesses here, right? There's Esther and Mordecai. There's always two witnesses. And they're witnessing on behalf of Reformation in church and state. I'm not going to develop all of these themes, but they're all there. So the king enters into covenant with the true church, the witnessing church. However, something is not yet right. The time is not yet come. Remember, Esther goes away for a while. And although Mordecai has exposed the plot against the king by some of his courtiers or court eunuchs, the king actually chooses to set Haman up as his chief advisor or first counselor instead of Mordecai. Now, we know that the kings of the earth have been warned to kiss the son lest they perish from the way. And the eternal son, when he came in the flesh, he was born to reign over the kings of the earth. For he was born King of Kings. And thus, the Magi, remember them? In Matthew 2:2, the Magi, the wise men from Persia, came seeking him. Because what happens, as I pointed out here in Esther's day, is retained in the knowledge of the wise men of Persia, down to the time of the coming of Christ. They came seeking him, saying, "Where is he that is born King of the Jews? For we've seen his star in the east and have come to worship him." In Luke's Gospel, in Luke 1:32-33, we are told of Jesus that he shall be great and shall be called the Son of the Highest, and the Lord God shall give unto him the throne of his father David, and he shall reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. He was born to be the king of the nations. But the nations, beginning with the Jews, rejected him. Likewise, Mordecai was most fit to be prime minister. But he was rejected by that Persian king. Instead, the Persian king chose Haman, a wicked act I actually alluded to previously, when I noted that the Jews believed that Elijah had come disguised in the person of Harbona in order to deal the death blow to Haman, whom they regarded to be the eschatological enemy of the church and people of God. Now, the death blow to the establishing of the satanic religion actually came not with Elijah per se, though his coming in the person of John the Baptist was a harbinger of the dawning of the new day. It came instead with Jesus Christ, the rock cut without hands, who we're told would deal a death blow to the kingdoms of the ungodly beasts that we see in Daniel's prophecies. It's also notable in Esther that it's a tree. That's a Hebrew word. It's a tree, word translated gallows, that separates the old world wherein the nations are kept removed from the true religion and the power of that religion being unleashed, through the church being properly established. It's separated by a tree. All right? And lest anybody should stumble at the fact that it's actually Haman who dies, we have to remember that it is sin that dies on the cross, not Christ. Christ arises. Sin is destroyed. But Christ arises. It's wickedness that is dealt the blow. If Satan had known, if the powers of darkness had known, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of glory. But that was the end. It destroyed them. And that's exactly what happened. Haman's gallows destroy him. You see, it's telling the story of the gospel. But it's telling you something about the state of the church. So when the promise of Christianity came into the world, the nations chose the false prophet over the true, didn't they? Again and again. Yes, there was an early reign which saw the spread of the Christian faith And so the beginning of Christianization in the empire, but very quickly that was corrupted. There will be a latter reign wherein the promises will come into their full realization on earth prior to the last judgment. In the interval, John, in his Apocalypse, tells us of the rise of the great Antichrist, the Roman Church, which as the harlot seated on the back of the scarlet beast, which is a symbol of the world empires, makes the earth to drip with the blood of the saints. This, then, is the eschatological Haman, which we read in Revelation 16 will be dealt its death blow at Armageddon sometime prior to the millennium. And that death blow is actually by the power and virtue of the cross. Remember, Jesus is actually the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. And it's the virtue of this that will make sure the demise of Antichrist and assure the binding of Satan for 1,000 years, no longer able to deceive the nations, as we read in Revelation 20. So how is all of this in Esther? Well, when the king becomes aware of the value of Mordecai, he seeks to honor him. And that follows upon the queen's bold petitioning to be admitted to the presence of the king. Esther, again, is a picture of the two witnesses, or the witnessing church, in Revelation. She is the one bringing that message at a time that might be unseemly. And yet there's a sense in which she's already been previously covenanted to the king. Now, if this sounds a little bit like the history of the Church of Scotland, perhaps there's a reason for that. Remember, the queen is the one who's faithful. Right? She's the one who's following Mordecai the prophet. She's the one who's actually following the one who's the type of Jesus. In contemplating the desire of the queen, then, that is, he's heard the witnessing church, the queen, speaking to him. The king is brought to a remembrance of who? Mordecai. See, that's just like the case of the woman in John's Gospel. The woman of Samaria. She goes back to tell all of those in her village that she had just met the Messiah. She's a picture of the church. And we're told that many believed on him, on Jesus, because of the saying of the woman. But then Jesus himself comes, and then we're told that many believed because they heard him for themselves. That's the difference between the external or the outward hearing of the word and the inward hearing. The encounter of the world is first with the outward hearing through the preaching of the word. But for those who are the elect world, they will believe because indeed in that they come to hear Jesus speaking. And so it's through the testimony of the faithful witnessing church that the nations are going to be brought to remember Jesus Christ. The king is brought then to a point of renewed interest in his covenant obligation as he becomes favorably disposed toward his queen. And it's that which leads to the downfall of Haman, who is the enemy of Mordecai and his people. So once the king is brought to his senses a bit, like the prodigal, he begins his return to his father. He could suffer no man to do harm to the queen, the witnessing church, and ultimately to the Israel of God. Now, appointing Haman was the king's flirtation with the religion of Antichrist and its insidious designs against the true religion. But destroying Haman and placing Mordecai in his place shows that the king has now not only made a covenant with the church, but the true religion is established in his kingdom, and this is going to show, this, as we're going to see, will bear a lot of fruit. Now, before we move on to the text, I do want to point out one more thing. According to the Jewish rabbis, Ahasuerus not only started out a very bad man, a Jew-hating heathen, but from their point of view, he remains so throughout the book to the very end. What they see in Esther is everything being bent to serve the interests of Israel. Everything is the constraint of providence to bend the will of a wicked king to support the Jews. And from their standpoint in history, this is actually understandable, and it strikes me as being quite right, because Paul says in his epistle to the Romans, for example, that the redemption of the Gentiles was a mystery that was kept hidden until the coming of Christ. And so, even though it's plainly taught in the Old Testament, and we could go over a number of passages where this is taught, the Jews continually stumble over this truth and fail to see how clearly it's taught by the prophets. Their eyes were, as it were, held shut to this particular truth. But from our standpoint, I would like to suggest that we can see in Ahasuerus the converting of a king and a kingdom as he's made to serve the interests of Christ toward the church and the true religion. And as I just said, this is going to bear great fruit in the book of Esther. And so as the typological character of the storyline develops, what I think we're going to see is the flowering of the millennial glory being shadowed forth. I think that's what's going on. And I think that's something we should be looking for as we get to these last couple chapters of Esther. So all of that, by way of getting to our verses. Verse 3. And Esther spake yet again before the king and fell down at his feet and besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman the Agagite and his device that he had devised against the Jews. And Esther spake yet again before the king. Now this reminds us, of course, the story doesn't just end with the hanging of Haman. The story of Haman is an important story, just as in the Bible, the story of Antichrist is an important story. But the destruction of Antichrist is not the end of the story. As long as the edict to destroy the Jews is floating around, the fact is here, Esther cannot remain silent. Though Mordecai has been elevated to the place of prime minister, I think that Esther is speaking here precisely because of the typology. Because Christ speaks to kings, not directly, but through his church. And by her renewed approach and by her demeanor, the king is, I think, already sure that Esther's not yet satisfied with the outcome of the events. After all, she's not simply concerned to see the destruction of Haman, just as the witnessing church is not simply concerned to see the destruction of Antichrist. She wants to see and is set for the salvation of Israel. We want to see the salvation of the nations. Haman's fall was not the end for which she'd initially come before the king. She's really looking for the conversion of the nations. And she's going to get that through the conversion of the Jews first. And that's another theme we have in the New Testament. Paul talks about this in Romans 11. Right? The Jews that have been cast away are not cast away forever. But they will return. And so there are 7,000 having bowed the knee. And when they rejoice, they fasted with Esther. We don't know who they are, but then all of the Jews, as a result of this, we're going to see, are turned. And their turning leads to the conversion of the Gentiles. And this is exactly the picture that we see in the New Testament. Right there, what will be their grafting in again, Paul says, but life from the dead for the Gentile nations. It will, if their casting away was an initial bringing of light to the Gentiles, how much more will their conversion be? But life again, a raising again. And here in this verse, the word again tells us she's seeking a second audience with the king. Right, no doubt this would be more difficult from her perspective, precisely because the first had been so successful. The king very clearly, in her mind, could look upon another approach as a good reason to just say no. Why? That's all the reason he would need, to say no. Because saying yes might be taken as a sign of weakness on his part. The fact is, in this second approach, she knew there could be no more invitations to banquets, nor is there going to be any surprise factor working in her favor. Right? She knew that she had really a single opportunity, if granted, to make her case and gain her request. And so she has to make the best of it. Esther spake yet again before the king and fell down at his feet. And the words used here indicate she's not doing a simple act of obeisance, but rather what she's doing is she's supplicating or petitioning at the feet of the king. Now, the reason for this, typologically, I think, is we're getting a reminder that in civil matters, the church must submit to the realm of civil matters, the realm of civil matters, anything belongs to that, to civil rulers, at least in all things which are lawful. So her act of supplication is both lawful and laudable. It represents the fact that the church is actually, in a well-ordered state, the church is a friend to civil order. And she knows that justice lies at the feet of all godly order, and she's there to get it. So she fell down at his feet and besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman the Agagite. It might be true that Haman is dead, but we know that his mischief outlives it. As Thomas McCree noted on this verse, I think so well, that we read of the judgments inflicted for the sin which Jeroboam caused Israel to sin long after that prince was rotten in his grave. Haman's edict, Haman's sin, that will live on even after the destruction of Haman. And so, though Antichrist is destroyed, it may well be that the sin of Antichrist will yet remain in the Church of God and will need to be removed by reform. Only reform, then, is going to remove this sin from upon the people of God. And that's why there is, I believe, that 75-year period between the end of the great apostasy and the beginning of the millennium. It's during that period of time that this is going to lead to this kind of purgation. Esther weeps and beseeches the king with all of her heart, because her heart is broken at the thought of such a breach of the moral law upon the Israel of God. She knows that this is God-provoking sin. Now perhaps I should remind you, the word translated mischief here is that Hebrew word for evil. So, although the power of evil has been broken when Haman was hanged, the effects of that evil, we're being taught, might still remain. And that too is something that every Christian comes to know when he exercises faith in Christ. Right? The power of evil has been broken, definitively, that is, as the apostle says, sin no more reigns over us, and yet there is this problem of indwelling sin, because the root of evil has been placed in us by nature. And so there is this tension. We've been released from the power of sin, and yet sin still works mischief or evil in us. Believers are not perfect, but we sin, and Jesus tells us in the Lord's Prayer that we should pray each day for the forgiveness of sin. Esther weeps, and so should we then, over the evil potential that dwells within. She knows that this can destroy the body of the church. Just as we should know, sin can destroy our bodies. It may no longer be able to destroy our souls, but it will destroy our bodies. I think Esther is notable in this heroic act because she shows us here that she actually places the well-being of the church above her own well-being, doesn't she? She prefers Jerusalem above her chief joy. When she'd made her initial visit to the throne room, although her own life had been placed in an immediate danger, if you recall, she neither bent to kneel, nor was she shedding any tears at that time. Now, there are a couple reasons for that. Of course, a weeping woman would not have been such a winsome object of delight when she went to invite the queen to a banquet. But here, now, we see she's willing to humiliate herself before the king for the sake of her people. By the way, we see in this that the witnessing church is, in fact, or should, in fact, be very much tied up with the interest of the whole church of God. We remain apart and aloof precisely because in that way we believe we can gain favor with God to bring about the reconciliation of His whole church. She makes her plea to one that she now has reason to believe is graciously disposed and powerful enough to act on her request. She's weeping as one assured that she's a beloved wife. And indeed, as we're going to see in the next verse, she doesn't arise until she's certain of a favorable answer from the king. Now, I think her mention of Haman would remind the king of the man who had devised this plan. Her calling of him here an Agagite is her confession that she knows that she's locked in the midst of a spiritual battle between good and evil, between the house of Saul and the house of Agag, if you will. But it's really between the Israel of God and the seed of the serpent. In all of this, then, she's an example of the kind of praying that we ought always to use to obtain our desires from the hand of our king. And she's going to remain on her face, prostrate before him, until she's attained that for which she's come. Remember in the Gospel of Mark, the answer that Jesus gave when his disciples couldn't cast out those demons, he said, these kinds don't go out except by prayer and fasting. Esther is a veteran of prayer and fasting. She's not going to give up until she's gained her cause. She doesn't just ask once, but she's prostrated herself before the king, and she intends to remain there until she gets what she's come for. She besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman the Agagite and his device that he had devised against the Jews. Now, the language that she uses here actually recalls the language of the prophet Jeremiah, Jeremiah 18:11. Now therefore go to speak to the men of Judah, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, saying, Thus saith the Lord, Behold, I frame evil against you, and devise a device against you. Return ye now, everyone, from his evil way, and make your ways and your doings good. I think it's very possible that Esther is recalling these words by way of acknowledging that although Haman had devised this plan, he had actually devised nothing against the Jews apart from the will of God. But God had set this upon them for judgment, but God had also, he's also set restraining bounds to the wickedness of Haman. The Jews actually couldn't perish from the earth because through them would come the Messiah. Nevertheless, Esther recognizes the threat is real. And though the promise extends to all Israel as a collective body, she also realizes that there's no hope for individual Jews apart from this promise being applied to them individually. It's just like the gospel. You don't just believe the gospel in the abstraction. It's not enough to believe that Jesus died for sin. You need to believe that he died for your sin. Esther's seeking to have the device or plan which Haman had planned removed through the just judgment of God. For the king, it must seem intolerable to let anything of Haman remain after he had dared to touch his beloved queen. And so, in the next verse, then the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther, so Esther arose and stood before the king. The king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. As I noted earlier, last time this happened, this is a sign of acceptance by the king. Of course, last time, the holding forth of the golden scepter meant life for herself, for Esther. But this time, the holding forth of the golden scepter actually portends life for her people. Esther is, after all, not approaching the king unannounced or without prior arrangement like she had in the previous encounter. All of this seems to have transpired in the course of the same day, the hanging of Haman and now this event. She's been with him or in and out with him throughout this entire day as all of these events are transpiring. So Esther would understand this to be a signal then of his gracious intent toward her and, more importantly for her, toward her people. With this signal, the magistrate acknowledges then the unique relation of his queen, the witnessing church, to Israel, the covenanted people of God. He's no longer going to hide behind a veil of indifference in matters of religion. He's no longer going to behave Gallio-like, who doesn't care for these things and just wants them to go away. He's now going to venture to do something positively and actively for the true religion. Holding out a scepter means he's willing. And I think that this is another reason why we need to reject this this notion that the Jews have that Ahasuerus just remains a very wicked man to the end of the book. And he may well personally, but in his conduct as a magistrate, he doesn't. But now he's become actively involved, and the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther, so Esther arose. No longer is she humiliated. She can arise. When does she arise? When does the witnessing church come into its own? When the king conscientiously acknowledges that his covenant with Esther entails being in covenant with the true God, that's when the church is rising. Like Esther, she's both able and willing to assume a position of exaltation with respect to the throne. Again, let me suggest this. What we see is the condition of the church entering the millennium here when Satan is bound so he can no longer deceive the nations. Haman has been destroyed. And the church now is about to enter into a glorious period of time. It's at the end of the great apostasy, when the two witnesses, the witnessing church, is slain. When the time of trouble is over, they stand up again upon their feet. So we're falling down before him is, in a sense, a slaying of the witness. But it's through her humiliation that she rises, and with her, the whole church is brought. The time of trouble is over. The two witnesses stand up again on their feet, as we see in Revelation 11. And through their ministry, what happens? We are told in Revelation, fear falls upon those who see them. And something very much like this will happen in the Persian kingdom. Something remarkably like this is going to happen now in the story of Esther. She arose and stood before the king. Her face is toward the king for her people. She stands before him. She stands before him with humility and modesty, but with a certain boldness. And here, I think she actually shows herself to be a model wife. She has all the qualities she needs to gain her husband's favor. Now, the reason is, humility and submission are the best things a wise woman can use whenever she fears the opposition of her husband, or whenever she simply wants to gain his permission for some just venture. Esther's aware of this, and she uses her best feminine ornaments. Esther stands because she has the wind of sound principle at her back, and she has the support of true religion as her foundation now. And this, combined with the apparent willingness of the king, certainly suggests to her, and I think rightly so, that the time for Zion's deliverance has come. All that she has to do is continue to speak forth the truth. Don't retreat. She has to call the king to favor Zion, the church. She has to remind him of his duty to do that which is right, not in his own eyes, but that which is right according to the moral law. And she has to encourage him to take right action to correct his injustices. And so in verse 5, she rose and stood before the king and said, if it please the king, and if I found favor in his sight, and the things seem right before the king, and I be pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews, which are in all the king's provinces. And said, if it please the king. Now Esther once more begins by using these words, by saying to the king, if it's good to the king, if it seems good to the king, or it's idiomatic, but by asking this, she's establishing, I think, that the king acknowledges the goodness of her addressing him, not only in this matter, but in this manner. And while this could express some sense of doubt, and perhaps did last time around when she used these words, I think here there appears to be Esther seeking more confirmation regarding things already spoken, with an eye to finding a remedy that's going to be acceptable in the sight of the king. But he's already acknowledged that Haman was a problem. And he's executed him. By extending the scepter, he's now indicated his willingness to address the evil plotting of wicked Haman toward the Jews. So whereas he might have tried to turn his head and deny the consequence of what Haman was doing prior to this, that's not the case anymore. Any hesitance, then, is not due to the king failing to understand that there's some inequity here. Any hesitance on the part of Esther is really more a matter of propriety and modesty. Instead, if it pleased the king, and if I found favor in his sight. Note that she continues using what appears in this book to be preferred manner of speaking when you're before the king. And it's precisely this regularity of this clause and the previous clause that will serve to highlight the unusualness, I think, of the next two clauses. These first couple of clauses, she's saying something that we have come to expect when someone addresses a king. Esther, of course, now has every reason to believe she's found favor, so that her asking is, again, I think here, more of a means to have the king place that firmly, not so much before her eyes, as before his own eyes, as she prepares to set forth her proposal. She wants him to take an active cognizance of his delight in her. Instead, if it please the king, and if I found favor in his sight, and the things seem right before the king. Now, this is interesting, because what she's asking is, I think, here now a question of advisability. And the reason is, the word right, the root word that's used here is actually it's an unusual word. Now, outside of the book of Esther, it's only really used in the book of Ecclesiastes, in Ecclesiastes 11:6, where it means to prosper or succeed. What Esther is asking is then, I think, for the king to consider whether or not her proposal is agreeable or suitable or perhaps even appropriate to the actions of a Persian king. But maybe there's a little bit more to it than that. Right? If we remember, she's already put him in mind of several things designed to encourage him to enact real justice and not to stay upon those legal fables of the Medes and Persians. Remember, the law of the Medes and Persians was what? Once it had been decreed, it can't be undone. Once it's been enacted, it remains a law to perpetuity. Right? You can't undo the law. Right? It becomes, by reason of the king enacting it, it becomes part of the highest constitution of the land, because the king's word is law. So he has to be careful what he says, and he has to be careful what is written down and decreed. But he hasn't done that, and so her proposal here, as we're going to see, suggests actually reversing a law already enacted, which is clearly contrary to their custom. So it may well be that Esther's use of this word, which is translated here right, is used because she's calling him to consider a higher law than that of the Medes and Persians when he makes his final decision regarding her proposal. It may be that she's recalling him to something much higher and much more important. And I do think that idea, which some of the commentators have put forth on this, has a lot of merit. It does seem that she's doing something like that. So she says, if it please the king, and I found favor in his sight, and the things seem right before the king, and I be pleasing in his eyes. Now, the best commentary that I found on this clause, I just want to read to you almost verbatim, because I think it's so good and so to the point on this particular clause. And I think, I'll recapitulate it after I read this, but Paulus Cassilis, who's a Jewish convert, points out that she goes on here to say, and I be pleasing, that is, tova, good in his eyes. Now, he says the word good is purposely chosen by her. He points out that according to the religious dualism of the Persian teaching, Ahriman is the evil, Ahura Mazda is the good God. So what she's doing is this. Evil was set, therefore, against the light and against the king, who represented the doctrine of Ahura Mazda. Evil was the king's enemy, and good was the devoted adherent to the king. So when Esther accuses Haman, she calls him Hara, the evil one. In contrast to this, she says now, and if it be good in his eyes, that is, if the king loves me and I appear pleasing, submissive, and attached. In other words, what he's pointing out is this. Esther is, in a very clever way, saying, if you really care about me, really love me, if you really care about me, I want you to listen to my proposal and I want you to adopt it. But she's doing so in a manner that couches all of this in language of cosmic significance. And that makes his response of cosmic significance as well. And I do think that that point of view here is, again, a well-merited observation. Because what he's going to do or not do is of that kind of importance. After all, there's a reason why the story's in the Bible. Right? God chose when to stop writing, but he didn't stop writing before he got to the story of Esther. It's here for a reason. She says, and if it pleased the king, and if I found favor in his sight, and the thing seemed right before the king, and I'd be pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. So she begins here by asking for another edict. She says, let it be written. And she wants something to reverse what has gone before. If the king ascertains that Esther's cause is right, that it's the proper thing to do, she's suggesting he should invalidate and revoke the previous edict by Haman. Now, although he can't unsay his own words, she does wish him to take suitable action so that it is as if they had never existed. That's the gist of what she's saying in the Hebrew here. By calling this edict the device or the plan of Haman, she makes it clear that it had not been issued for the good of the state. But instead, this edict had been issued to please Haman by enacting his own private vengeance, or personal vengeance, for his own private vendetta against the Jews. Now, referring to him here as the son of Hammedatha, whose name means given by a deity, that brings out the religious contest that's going on here. Haman, as I noted some time ago, a number of weeks ago, was most likely the son of a pagan priest and therefore most likely himself also a priest. And just as his elevation signaled the elevation of traditional Persian pagan religion, coaxing the king to react to this man as such, as a religious figure, is in order to get the king to act on behalf of the true religion knowingly and openly. Again, the reference to the Agagites, a reminder of the ages-long conflict between Israel and Agag, the seed of the woman, the seed of the serpent. Now, I know that in saying this, Esther is sort of glossing over the king's own involvement in this plot once more. But why not? Right? He is now set to defend the true religion, which is what the church should expect from a magistrate favored with the light of special revelation. Let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews, which are in all the king's provinces. Here, Esther makes her plea on behalf of the true covenanted religion. And she suggests that a decision in favor of the Jews would actually have far-reaching effects in the empire, in the kingdom. The Jews were scattered everywhere through the kingdom. They were in every province, apparently. Now, telling the king this, or reminding him of this, or suggesting this, is akin to telling the king that he has potentially loyal constituents everywhere who are about to be destroyed by the plotting of a man who had sought to destroy the kingdom through his false religion. And that by embracing the true religion, you embrace the security of your kingdom. And that's true. That's very true. In conclusion, I just want to say that as Esther now speaks to the king, she's asking him to do something that would run against the pride of any Persian monarch. Right? Her demand in asking for this reversal or revocation is really asking him to divest himself of the aura of divine glory that the Persian people understood to be vested in the throne. That's why his word, which was law, was unretractable. It couldn't change. He has to admit in this that he's not God. He's not a God. That he's under the true God. And that he's in submission to the true religion. Now, to do so was to risk unsettling the traditional pagan faith of the Persian people. And it was to court the possibility of disturbances within the affairs of state. It's a very unsettling thing. The difficulty surrounding him might even remind us of the problem that presented itself to Christ when he, in the face of the sentence of condemnation upon the sinner on the part of justice, still made provision for grace. Right? The law of God is unchanging. But how do we make provision for grace? That was answered in Christ. And the answer for the king is also going to be found in Christ. The king must find a way to uphold the law while making provision for grace for the people of God. Because he now knows that he's to serve the dictate of a higher law to which even kings must bow if they wouldn't perish in the way. Amen.